Welcome to Asian Pacific Voices Radio, where you'll find stimulating conversations that explore diverse topics and stories impacting our Asian Pacific American communities. I'm your host, Rasha Goel, and today I'm excited to have a very incredibly talented, award-winning author, travel writer, film producer, and underwater photographer. From becoming Thailand's youngest English writing author with multiple national best-selling novels to representing literary clients at esteemed agencies like the former ICM Partners and contributing her creativity to major film production companies and studios like Sony Pictures and A Major Media, her journey in the world of storytelling is nothing short of extraordinary. It's my pleasure to welcome Pierre Nirandara on Asian Pacific Voices Radio. Thanks for being here, Pierre.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here and to be speaking with fellow Asians in the space and a topic that's very near and dear to my heart.
Oh, well, we're excited to have you. Just you've accomplished so much. And I have to tell you, I talked to so many different people on our show, and there's very few that are from Thailand. So I'm excited to hear about your journey of growing up in Thailand. Let's start off with your background. I mean, very impressive, very accomplished. You have gone, as I mentioned earlier, from being an author, which you still are, film producer, to underwater photographer and an expedition leader. So tell us a little bit about your journey as an author, which I understand began at a very young age, and then what inspired you and how you were able to accomplish some of your successes. And before I let you answer, I'm going to jump in and congratulate you on recently winning the Lowell Thomas Awards and the Grand Solis Awards for Best Traveling Writing of the Year. Quite an accomplishment.
Thank you so much. It's crazy to think how far things have come, I guess, because in some ways I still feel like that, you know, 15-year-old kid writing in a house in Thailand by herself. So like words that only she was reading. So I guess it all goes back to Bangkok. I grew up as an only child living in a house in a situation where, you know, if I was bored and I wanted to go see my friends, I couldn't just ride down the street or walk down the street to go see them. I was kind of contained by myself with nothing to do but read. And inevitably, I think that just led to writing. There's that feeling that I used to get, and I still do sometimes. I think it's that awe and that wonder when you read a really, truly incredible story that touches you, the characters, the voices, and the worlds. And I just really wanted to convey that emotion and give that feeling to someone else. So I have a very specific memory of being a kid. And I think I was 14 or 15 when the first book was written. And we sent in the manuscript to the publishers in Thailand, who at the time were the biggest publishers of children's literature. So they published the Harry Potter series, you know, every like big children's book you can think of. And we sent it in. They called this massive board meeting. And I went in, I was 15. And the first question they asked was, did you write this? And I was like, well, yeah, of course I did. Like, who else would have written it? I was so perplexed. And then in hindsight, realizing that they had never had a kid, let alone, you know, like a 15-year-old kid writing in English in Thailand. Back then, the literary scene was predominantly just Thai writers writing in Thai. And so it was a really exciting and scary time, too, to be the first. And they didn't really quite know what to do with me. But they were like, OK, well, we have to publish this. But the strategy is going to be interesting. And we wound up translating it into Thai. And then we did like cartoon versions. And so it was all, yeah, it was a really big learning journey and really fun experience and a time of my life that I look back on. And now I'm like, wow, I can't believe that actually happened.
But that's pretty incredible. I mean, at the age of 15, you know, to be able to go and walk into an office like that and have something as huge as your publication, that's pretty incredible, I'm going to say.
Yeah, it was really nerve. I mean, I remember them saying like, okay, well, here are the books that we publish. And it was, you know, Harry Potter, Artemis Fowl, Septimus Heap, like all these. And I was like, oh my God, I love all of these. These are my favorites. And I started like quoting them. And they're like, okay, so she really did write this book. And we were so fortunate because I can write and read Thai, but I wouldn't say my Thai is literary. And we were so fortunate. We wound up getting the translator for the Harry Potter series, Ajahn Sumali, who translated my books into Thai. So wow.
First book, Pierre? What was the name of the book?
So it was a trilogy, and the first one's called The Mermaid Apprentices, and it's part of the Interspecies Trilogy. So it's, you know, kids finding out that kids going on adventures, finding out that they've been chosen to become ambassadors between humans and the merfolk, which is, I did model UN in school, so I think it definitely bled into my writing of like diplomacy, and it's all an allegory for xenophobia and like creatures hating each other and stuff like that. But yeah, it was really fun to write, and I get to meet adults nowadays who grew up, like, you know, I'll meet them and they'll be like, wait, are you the mermaid girl? And they'll be like, we grew up reading your books. So that's really, really cool.
Wow. Do you have a secretly stashed mermaid outfit somewhere? I have to ask you.
Oh my gosh. I actually, you know what? I don't. I think I wish I did. I definitely have like mermaid printed stuff, but yeah, I should actually get in on that. Maybe that's not a bad idea, right? Especially with the free diving now.
Well, all right. So let's jump from being an author to working in the film industry, because that is quite a huge leap. And we know what a competitive world that also can be. So how did you get into representing literary clients? And then you went on later to work for major studios like Sony Pictures and companies like A Major Media.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think at the end of the day, it's all been about storytelling for me. I wanted initially to go into publishing and to work in that space, go figure. And then found myself actually interning at ICM Partner, or at a production company, and then ICM Partners, and was like, wait, there's another way to tell stories, and there are more stories to tell than just my own. You know, like some stories I want to write myself, there are other ones I want to help shepherd. And so I was incredibly fortunate to go work at ICM and in their literary department. So representing writers and directors and also authors in book to film rights. So helping sell book rights to become, you know, either films or TV shows, and representing clients and working on both sides of the creative process.
How fun. And, you know, I have to let my audience here know that you were once the vice president of film and television at Major Media, which was Hollywood's first Asian American production company. And you also consulted on Netflix's Thai Cave Rescue Limited series, which was so incredible, by the way, and is based on a true story. It's a very heart-wrenching story, I will say. Tell us more about your experiences on being involved in that project. It's got to have been also heartfelt to you, especially since it represented the region, right?
So it was crazy. When the events actually happened, I remember I was traveling in Colombia at the time. I was just like on a trip. And a news company actually reached out and asked me to write a story covering it from a Thai diver's perspective. Because I think there maybe aren't a lot of like English writing Thai divers out there. So I was very familiar with the story. And then just through sheer luck, I guess I had producing friends who were adapting that and who were making the TV show version. And they were very, very adamant on making it right and telling it from the Thai perspective, not just like white saviors. So they, you know, asked me to consult on it. And then I think they did a really, really good job at making sure that it was portrayed accurately. So this is when I was working at A Major Media. And before that, I was at Sony Pictures, also doing international content focused on bringing stories that were like felt like they had a kind of global universality to them, that no matter where you're from in the world, you can relate, and then translating that for different audiences.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I do remember that with Thai Cave Rescue, that they were very adamant on making sure that the accuracy was there. So I'm glad that you also saw that.
Yeah, I mean, the story itself it's so crazy on its own. It really doesn't need to be fictionalized that much, because it's just like one of the craziest things to ever happen. And being a Thai person, you could really see it was uniting a country. That was what was interesting about it. It's like we've had a lot of political situations, a lot of coups, and a lot of, I think, just like different sides. But when that event happened, it didn't feel just like all of Thailand. It was like the entire world came together to rescue these kids.
Yes, you really saw that humanity factor, and how we can all be one at one time when we are really fighting for one cause. It was beautiful. My heart, I was just like holding on to my seat as I was watching, because I was like, how are they doing this? Let's talk about being underwater. Now, in addition, you're also an avid underwater photographer and a paddy and bass diver. You've been recognized at prestigious competitions such as Ocean Photographer of the Year, and you also founded a company called Immersive Expedition. So is that related to your diving club, Hollywood Sharks?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I mean, so diving and writing have been something, the water and writing have been in my life since I was very young, hence why my first book was about mermaids. I think there's a lot that actually tracks here. But when I was at Sony, I started a unofficial kind of Hollywood diving club. I figured, hey, if, you know, people can have golf clubs and tennis clubs and whatever, we can have a diving club, or just like a water loving organization with the goal of hopefully getting people into the water and execs and producers into the water so that they'll care more about the marine environment and stop like making killer shark films. And for some reason, the Hollywood Reporter caught wind of that, ran this article on it, of this feature. And I got so many more calls from execs that I never knew, like big producers, partners across the industry who were like, oh my God, you have a diving club? I love diving. So that kind of came from, I guess, just from wanting to connect people and share in that awe and that wonder that I mentioned earlier. And then it became Immersive Expeditions, which is I've been leading trips to go swim with big marine animals for a couple of years now, but always under someone else's banner. And I figured it was eventually time to kind of start my own. So yeah, we do a handful of trips every year, and we specialize in big animal encounters. So swimming with the humpback whales, sharks, dolphins, feeding bait balls, things like that.
Oh my gosh, that is so cool. Now, do you have to be a diver to be able to do that? Because I am obsessed with sea life.
So you don't actually, and this is one of the parts of it, is that I, as much as I love scuba diving, it's a big barrier to entry to a lot of people, both in terms of, you know, economically, and it's also, it's a privilege to be able to access those spaces, right? So my goal was to democratize the arena and hopefully, you know, get it in a way where most of these trips that we do, yes, they are, you know, we call them diving, but it's actually mostly like snorkeling and freediving. So you're at the surface because A, it's, you have to be able to keep up with the animals. They're very fast. And with scuba, you're quite weighted down and cumbersome. And then the other thing is just you want to open up the space. So, you know, someone can, as long as you're like a fit swimmer, like you can swim, and if, you know, there's a big animal, we tell you to jump and you don't have a problem jumping, then you're suited for the trip.
Oh, I'm going to have to look into this. I don't know. This sounds, I'm so fascinated with sea life and water mammals. So this sounds really exciting. And this is another reason why you have to get that mermaid outfit, because now with your connection to water.
Well, I dive with a really good friend of mine who's known as the Black Mermaid, and we photograph her. Ooh. I photographed her in a tail before. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting themes also on representation of the marine, in marine spaces. Like as a kid, you know, you think of mermaid, you think of Little Mermaid, you think of a white mermaid. What does it mean now to have representation in those areas that we were previously excluded from?
I love that, Pierre. So it's so beautiful. And you know, you're also a world traveler. I can't believe you visited over 90 countries across 7 continents. And I understand that solo female travel is really, it's an important cause for you. So what advice do you have for aspiring female travelers? And how do you believe that solo travel empowers women to explore the world?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I don't think I'm any different from any other woman at all. I think that solo travel is something that, I mean, it is definitely a privilege, but it's also something that should be accessible to everyone. Unfortunately, the world, you know, you have to be realistic about the world. You can't, there's certain things that I wouldn't do as a woman that I think a guy could do. You just have to be more aware of your surroundings. If you're abroad, like don't get inebriated and walk out at night. Like there's just really basic common sense rules. But I do think that, I don't know, I feel like the world is, for the most part, people do come from a good place. And if you go in with your heart open and, you know, you trust your instincts, but don't go in from a place of suspicion and kind of like putting, already setting yourself up for distrust. If you go in, like I have met the kindest, most wonderful people in all corners of the world, no matter where you are. And if you go in with that mentality, like you'll be surprised what you receive in return.
Is there a memorable experience that you could share with us that you felt also impacted your creative work?
Yeah. Oh, creative work. I mean, there's so many. The one that I cite a lot is the Sardine Run, which is this like my favorite expedition of the year. I do it almost every year. And it's the biggest, in terms of biomass, it's the biggest migration in the world. So it's when sardines migrate up the coast of South Africa. And with them come these like massive predators that hunt them. So you're swimming with bait balls. It's like Blue Planet action. Bait balls with sharks, dolphins, whales, diving birds. And it's just pure adrenaline. And this was the trip that really, really catalyzed me to come back to my Hollywood career and was like, what am I doing with my life? And am I living? And it really inspired me to kind of strap on a backpack and get out of that comfort zone.
I love that though, because I think it's so free spirited and such a free soul. And, you know, one of the things that inspired me as I was reading about your journey more when I was researching was that you really took a moment to step away from the hustle and bustle of world and really go embrace, because it's hard when you're working in Hollywood too. We just get so caught up in this circle, which could be vicious. And you really embraced that there's so much more out there, right, to living than just working in this industry.
Well, I think there's also something interesting to be said about, especially when people of color solo travel or shake off kind of the comfort zone. You know, I was very fortunate in that my parents were very un-Asian in the sense that they were, you know, they were pretty relaxed with me, and all the pressure to ever succeed came from an internal drive within myself. But, you know, I think if you grow up with Asian parents, a lot of the times you have this pressure to perform, conform, and also to live life a certain way. And sometimes I feel like when I meet a fellow Asian person on the road or in the water, I'm always like, huh, you have an interesting story, or a creative Asian person. Like, a lot of people who work in Hollywood who are Asian, they didn't just fall into it. They weren't like, oh yeah, my parents, like, you know, paid for me to do an MFA in screenwriting. Like, that doesn't happen as often as, yeah. So there's this additional layer and the intersectionality that's really fascinating to me. And when you compound that with the water, like, I can say that in terms of underwater photography, I mean, I probably count on one hand the number of other like Asian women doing it in the space at the level that, you know, it's like, I think I know like one or two other people who are like big, big DOPs for the blue chip stuff. So it's really interesting.
I'm sure that's rare, but what a beautiful talent to have. How do you manage your time, Pierre? Because you've definitely got your hands in these different fields and you're excelling in all arenas. So how do you manage your time?
I joke that, I mean, I don't know if I'm managing it as well as I could be, but I joke that I have 3 to 4 simultaneous careers going on, and it is really tough. I think I'm slowly learning to be better at letting go of things, and also to learn to outsource, learn that you don't have to be the best at everything. You could also, you know, like my mom always taught me growing up, she was like, there are people that are going to be better than you, and you should just like trust them and hire the right people to do that job. So I think that's the next step for me is, unfortunately, a lot of the work that I do, I have to do personally, you know, like writing, photography, I can't really outsource that, but leading expeditions or opening up the space, I want to create a scholarship program for people who wouldn't be able to access these trips to be able to join, especially like local people in those communities. I want to open up the space where there's like a, you know, instead of me leading the trip, maybe I bring on a marine biologist who would otherwise not have the opportunity to run an expedition, but who would be a huge added benefit for the clients. So stuff like that, that's in the works. And it also allows me to outsource and not have to do everything myself.
Yeah, I love that. But I love that piece of advice too, because I feel like sometimes, especially as women, don't you feel like we're just kind of used to taking it on? Like, I can do it. I can manage it. I'm just,
yeah.
Especially with, like you said, a lot of stuff that you're doing, we kind of need Pierre to be there and doing that.
There's also a degree of perfectionism, I think, that's like sometimes we're perfectionists to a fault, you know, like everything needs to be perfect. And what I learned was like, it doesn't need to be. Like, sometimes you just need to take the shots. I think it was Hemingway or someone who said the first draft of anything is shit, right? So not everything you touch has to turn to gold. Not everything you do has to be success. And oftentimes you actually learn so much more from your failures as well.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Talk to me a little bit about what you're working on right now. Any new novels in the work? What themes or topics are you exploring?
Yeah. So I actually, my latest novel that I've been working on for a couple of years now, which, knock on wood, we'll see the light of day soon, is actually an anti-Eat, Pray, Love. So, you know, most Eat, Pray, Love narratives are told from the white woman's perspective who goes to Europe, eats pasta, falls in love with a white man. I kind of wanted to take that trope or like all those themes and subvert them. And so it's about an Asian American mixed race girl who goes to South Africa and is tracing the footsteps of her late mother's journey when she finds out that her late mother, contrary to what she believed her entire life, she thought her mom was like the perfect Asian daughter. She was actually a budding journalist during the tail end of apartheid. So she kind of like discovers all these old stories and these like memorabilia from her mother's journeys, and she sets off on the footsteps. So it's like it's a love letter to South Africa. It's fiction. It's definitely people are like, oh, is that based on your life? I'm like, no, but the stories, some characters, some adventures, the places, the themes, and I wanted to explore the magic and the privilege of backpacking and the road, and also just like subverting a lot of these tropes that we see in travel literature.
Pierre, I love it.
And maybe show a little bit of representation in it as well.
Oh my gosh, it sounds exciting. And I'm envisioning this as a film as well as you're talking about it.
Yeah, there have been some inquiries, but it's still really early days. So we'll see what happens.
I'm going to end with asking you, because of your background as well, how important do you think cultural diversity and representation are in the entertainment industry as we continue to evolve? And what changes do you personally hope to see in the future for more inclusivity and authenticity when it comes to storytelling?
I mean, I love these questions, and I love that it's something that people are now thinking about. I mean, at my last official full-time job in Hollywood, you know, I was working at as VP at A Major Media, which is the first Asian American driven production company in Hollywood. So that was a really exciting time. When I first started in the industry, I remember I'm very Asian American passing, even though I grew up abroad. And I would never tell people that I grew up in Thailand. And I would, because people didn't want to sponsor visas, they didn't want to hire you if you were not from America. And now it's like actually cool to be international. It's cool to be different. You know, it gives you a different perspective into the stories. And something that's really interesting to me is that we're not monoliths, right? Like, where we really have to push towards narrative plenitude instead of narrative scarcity. So, you know, if there's one Asian movie that doesn't do well, suddenly you can't make Asian movies. Like, that's not the truth. The truth is that we're so diverse. We're so different. We're not just like this monolithic kind of like typecasted person. There's so much nuance and complexity to not just Asians, but like even Thai people within the Thai community. There's different types of Thais. So I really, really want to see more representation in that space. And, you know, hopefully some of the stories I'll be the one telling and other stories I will help get them made. So fingers crossed. But it's an exciting time to be an Asian person.
Oh, it absolutely is. I love that you shared that. And one memory or one thing that you'd like to share about the Thai culture that maybe people don't know about, aside from the amazing Thai food.
Yeah, I mean, the food's pretty hard to beat. I will say, you know, people ask me all the time, like, oh, like, you know, I'm going to go to Thailand. What should I do? And one of my favorite Thai things to do actually is Songkran, which is our Thai New Year. So it's every April. It shifts with like the lunar calendar, but it's during the hottest time of year. It's like sweltering. It's disgustingly hot, but then it's basically a nationwide water fight. So you like in the morning, you go to the temple and you like do all the like the cultural stuff and like pour water and then, you know, say, get your blessings from the monks. And then in the afternoon, it's just a nationwide water fight and everyone has like water guns and they're just spraying water everywhere. And it's just so much fun. And the country really comes together during the time of year. So for me, that's like a memory that I have very close to heart. And I just went back there this year to do Songkran again. And it was like a core memory type of thing. So highly recommended for anyone who hasn't.
Oh, how fun. And thank you for sharing that. Something new that I learned about the community and the culture. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Pierre, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. You're just so insightful and so many amazing, incredible things to share. So thank you for being here. Where can our audience find you?
Yeah, I'm at pierrenirandara.com or my Instagram is at pierresgreatperhaps, which in hindsight, I realized that it sounds like my friend was like, oh, does that mean you're great perhaps? No, it's from like, it's like a riff off of the last of like the final lines of like a French poet who was dying. So it's like a poetry reference that no one seems to get. But I'm on mostly predominantly on Instagram because of photography and or pierrenirandara.com.
Pierre Nirandara, thank you so much for being on our show. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. I want to thank you once again for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a pleasure.
Oh, it's so much fun. And for all my viewers and listeners, we'd love to hear from you. So if you have any suggestions about future guests or topics, please do reach out to us. And don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, X, Instagram, and our YouTube channel. Asian Pacific Voices Radio is produced by Asian Culture and Media Alliance, a nonprofit that empowers the Asian Pacific American communities with a voice through media arts. And if you'd like to support our program, please do visit us at AsianPacificVoicesRadio.com. Once again, I'm Rasha Goel. Thank you for joining me for another exciting episode. And do visit us next week on Asian Pacific Voices Radio. Until then, take care.